Let's enjoy.
Hello and welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station. I'm Philip Stempion. Coming up on The Wire today.
The attention of Australian media has shifted from the conflict in Eastern Europe in general and in Ukraine especially, but things haven't cooled down.
The situation in Ukraine is worsening. Battles between the Ukrainian military and Russian-backed separatists are becoming more frequent and more deadly as Moscow continues to deny any involvement in the region. Also on The Wire today, we speak with tennis great Jelena Djokic, who chronicles her suffering from her father, Dimitar Djokic's abuse in her early career in her new book, Unstoppable. Stay tuned for all this and more on The Wire. Following the Royal Commission into the Protection and Detention of Children and Universal Children's Day, doctors, lawyers and human rights groups are calling for the legal age of criminal responsibility to be raised from 10 years to 14 years old. Around 600 children under 14 years old are held in detention facilities across Australia, with 70% being of Indigenous heritage. Annalisa Gracious has more.
Dr. Mick Creety, a senior fellow at the Royal Australasian College of Physicians, says children under the age of 14 have not developed the cognitive and decision-making capacity to be trialled within the criminal justice system.
From a medical perspective, there's lots of evidence that's come out in the last 4 or 5 years that the part of your brain that controls impulses, decision-making and thinking is not fully developed until around the age of 23 or 24, 25 years of age. So we're seeing children as young as 10, 11, 12, 13, who we know have got very poor impulse control, being incarcerated for what we think are developmentally normal behaviours. For example, we know that even in adults, impulse can override logic. You can imagine a scenario. If you're waiting in line at a supermarket, you're a bit bored, you see a chocolate, you buy the chocolate even though you know that's not the best thing to do. Amplify that to a 13-year-old who's got poor impulse control. His mates get in a car which is stolen, they ask him to join in. He's a bit bored, he joins in. He can now be charged with a crime for an impulsive act. And because he's been charged, he can be held in a custodial setting, which we know is not good for his psychology and well-being.
As a paediatrician who specialises in adolescent health, Dr. Creety suggests that these children are not a danger to society and should not be locked up in detention centres.
In all jurisdictions in Australia, a child can be charged at the age of 10 with a crime. And just being charged, not even being found guilty, just being charged with a crime allows a child to be held in detention or custody. Most of the crimes, in inverted commas, that younger children have allegedly done are not so much against people, but more against property. So this worry that people may be, that young people may hurt people or injure other people, that's actually less of a behaviour in young people. Most of the actions that get younger kids in trouble with the law, actions against property like stealing things, getting into stolen cars, graffiti, and that's not a danger to the general society. So to lock these children up is crazy. It's just really detrimental. There's no doubt that children need to have consequences for their actions, but we strongly believe that the youth justice system is not the place for this to happen. Children need counselling at times. Their families need support. And we should see this as a welfare matter, not as a criminal matter. We know that children who are removed from families, who are removed from the education system, and who are removed from positive peer relationships have worse outcomes as adults and your adult identity.
Shalina Musk, senior lawyer at the Human Rights Law Centre, says conviction of a crime could impact a child's future.
Any offence which a child has been dealt with formally by a court will result in a finding of guilt, especially if there's been a recording of a conviction in relation to offences that becomes part of the child's criminal record that could potentially follow them for life.
Shalina reveals many children are being held in isolated facilities similar to an adult prison.
In the Northern Territory, where children are currently being housed, that is the former adult maximum security prison, Berrima. and it's been regazetted as Don Dale Youth Detention Facility. So it is a prison. With all the barbed wire, the same concrete cells, a slab for the bed with a mattress on it. It very much reflects all the characteristics of an adult prison.
Shalina says detention facilities are highly ineffective and children would greatly benefit from targeted intervention programs.
The evidence is all there and it's been reflected in the findings of the Royal Commission that early intervention, prevention and diversionary programs are more effective in actually addressing the root causes of young persons offending.
Indigenous children are overrepresented in detention facilities. Their removal from their communities is detrimental to their mental health.
In the Northern Territory, 96% of children in prison are Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. Most of these children come from quite remote regions of the Northern Territory. My experience as a lawyer, having worked with these children, their experience, I would say, based on what they've told me and observations, were more distressing and quite harmful. I had children coming from remote regions like Wadair, Portkeith, hundreds of kilometres away from where they're being detained, and the disconnection from family, community, culture and the support networks caused a lot of distress, and I had a lot of children threatening to self-harm, threatening to suicide, and the development of mental health issues as a result of the disconnection and the isolation.
Shalina advocates for changes to the legal criminal age of responsibility and for alternate measures to be put in place for children under the age of 14.
Shalina Mosk, senior lawyer with the Human Rights Law Centre, ending that report by Analicia's Gracias. With critical seats still in the balance, the AOP under Anastasia Palaszczuk are nonetheless looking for the goods to form another Labor government in Queensland. Not only did the LNP under Tim Nicholls fail to engage the electorate, particularly in the southeast of the state, One Nation appears to have derailed the LNP vote in many critical seats. Roderick Chambers asked Dr. Stuart Jackson, lecturer in politics at the University of Sydney, what were the seeds of the LNP disaster.
And Qatar actually doing well in a number of seats. It seems to have caught, I think, everybody slightly off guard. I mean, everybody thought that One Nation was going to do really well, but they've done really well, but not well enough. So the expected huge surge that was going to lead them to win many, many seats didn't come off in that way. But what it did is it won enough votes to be challenging both Labor and Liberal. And, of course, which way their votes split, of course, is going to make many people's lives quite interesting, I'm afraid.
Many people said that they expected One Nation to get more seats, but in hindsight, it would have been quite difficult because nobody was preferencing them, were they?
No. Well, quite a lot of Qatar votes were going to them, and in some of those seats, that makes a difference. Could change the preference flows, could mean that some people who thought they were going to win might end up losing. There's a couple of seats like that.
And if Anastasia Palaszczuk remains good to her promise not to form government with anybody else, if she gets 46 seats, does that mean that she won't be forming a government?
No, she probably would still form government. And the question for the governor, and indeed the question for the minor parties, is, you know, will they get together to support the LNP? Certainly the Labor Party is the party with the most seats. It has the opportunity to form government, and indeed it exists as the government. Technically it's in caretaker mode at the moment. The Premier is still the Premier. Unless they're prepared to put up a motion of no confidence, they will remain. Palaszczuk would remain the Premier.
Is it really that much of a difference from the results from last election? That was pretty hard to form a government as well, wasn't it?
The differences in the quantum of votes that each of the parties got. The last election, it was fairly clearly big swings against the LNP that the Labor Party was able to feast off and do well out of. This time round, the Labor vote has not really gone anywhere. It's slid back slightly. The LNP's taken a bit of a hit overall, so they would be smarting from the success of One Nation. Quite strongly, actually. They really did get quite thumped.
And you'd wonder why, because One Nation politically dropped so many balls in the election campaign, you'd think, how on earth would anyone vote for them?
What you're seeing, particularly where they ran, you know, have to keep in mind that they ran in only 60, 61-odd seats out of the 93. So So they weren't running in all particularly urban seats, and certainly people in the inner urban areas, which potentially the ones who are seeing and you know perhaps picking up on the mistakes of One Nation, that's where it would have affected them most. In the country, it's a generally, or certainly regional Queensland, much more anger directed more generally, partly at Labor, partly at the Liberal National Party, but more particularly at the Liberal National Party. And perhaps One Nation has really tapped into a sentiment that's a bit us and them. It's a bit regional versus the city.
And what do you think the implications are for the federal government? You know, Malcolm Turnbull says there are no implications, but he would say that, wouldn't he?
He would indeed. I think they are serious ramifications. If these numbers were repeated, there's a whole series of seats that the LNP would lose, particularly in the southeast, but potentially in the north. These are serious numbers for them to get their heads around. They could actually be looking at losing government alone out of Queensland. If these votes were replicated, it would be disaster for the coalition.
Dr. Stuart Jackson, lecturer in politics at the University of Sydney, ending their report by Roderick Chambers. The war in eastern Ukraine is flaring up again as the Ukrainian Defence Minister alleges that Russia has deployed thousands of armoured vehicles and troops into Ukraine. Philip Stempion investigates. Over the weekend, the war in Ukraine has seen the worst fighting in months. On Sunday, two Ukrainian soldiers were killed and four were wounded by a mortar and grenade attack in eastern Ukraine. They are the latest casualties in a war that is quickly becoming forgotten.
The attention of Australian media has shifted from the conflict in Eastern Europe in general and in Ukraine especially, but things haven't cooled down.
Dr. Olga Olenikova is the founder and director of the Ukrainian Democracy Initiative.
Many, many experts on Ukraine and many politicians avoid using the word war to what is happening in Ukraine. But we should use this word to describe it because we can't continue calling it anti-terrorist operation. So officially, it's called anti-terrorist operation, which is happening in the eastern Ukraine. But by fact, it's a war. And it's 4 years now as it's happening.
Since the conflict began in late November of 2013, the number of deaths has climbed into the thousands. Dr. Olenikova has family in Kiev and her husband has family in Donetsk. Young people from Donetsk have migrated to Kiev or further west to Poland and the Czech Republic. Older people have chosen to stay in the city, which has become the capital of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic. Dr. Olenikova says the Ukrainian people have become used to war and try to carry out their lives as normally as possible.
You have this feeling that the Ukraine is different as it was before the revolution, in some good sense and some negative sense as well. Yeah, so you definitely have this vibe, psychological vibes, when you talk to people in the streets, you sit in a cafe and all the topics that are discussed are basically around the crisis, right, around the economic problems as well, around the Russian annexation of Crimea and Russian basically intervention, right, in the eastern Ukraine and support of what is happening there. There's a lot of talk around that.
In August, a ceasefire deal was signed by the Ukrainian government and the separatists. Dr. Alexei Muriev is the head of social sciences and security studies at Curtin University, and he says both sides have never honoured that ceasefire deal.
Ceasefire agreement between the separatists and Ukrainian authorities was not really honored by either side of the conflict. Low-level skirmishes continue to occur on a regular basis, artillery barrage. It's a low-level intensity confrontation with the prospect to a high-level escalation in due course.
The Ukrainian defense minister said last week that Russia has deployed thousands of armored vehicles and troops into Ukraine. What has been the Russian response to those claims?
Well, the Russians ignore what the Ukrainian authorities are saying. A deployment of thousands of vehicles and troops cannot go unregistered, cannot go unnoticed, because the conflict has been closely monitored through a number of ways, space-based surveillance, aerial surveillance, human intelligence. There is a peacekeeping mission of the Organization of Security Cooperation in Europe on the ground. So this large-scale insurgency of Russian offensive firepower into eastern Ukraine, if it did take place, wouldn't simply go unregistered.
President Donald Trump has been presented with an option to send lethal weapons to Ukraine by the National Security Council, which is the principal forum for foreign affairs in America. Dr. Muriev says NATO already supplies Ukraine with lethal weapons.
There's been more talk about the United States supplying Ukraine, say, with anti-tank missiles lately, and according to some reports, this system's already been delivered to Ukraine.
Previous United States President Barack Obama rejected providing weapons to Ukraine because of fears it would escalate the conflict and worsen America's relations with Russia at the time. If Donald Trump approves the lethal weapons deal, which is set to cost $47 million, it could escalate this proxy war even further.
Russia-US relations has been at its lowest level since the climax of the Cold War. So it would also probably justify Russia's supply of offensive firepower to the separatists in an overt way, because the Russians could come back and say, well, since the United States now engaged in the conflict directly, since the United States is providing with Ukrainian military with offensive firepower, we can now provide similar systems to people of Eastern Ukraine. Obviously, the Russians don't describe them as separatists. And that may actually trigger the escalation of conflict and the buildup of tensions at a new level. So it may trigger a mirror response from Russia.
Dr. Alexei Muraviev, Head of Social Sciences and Security Studies at Curtin University, ending that report. I'm Philip Stempien, and you're listening to The Wire around Australia. Jelena Djokic is one of the brightest tennis stars Australia has ever produced, but her relationship with her father has at times overshadowed her career. Roger Chambers spoke to Jelena about her new book and her story of survival.
It was very hard for a very long time, but I felt like for a while I knew I would write a book, and there were, it was just a matter of when I would be ready. And the last, let's say, 2 or 3 years, I felt like I'm okay to talk about everything.
And you came to Australia in 1994 from Croatia via Serbia, I should say. Your father's Serbian, your mother's Croatian. Was it a dangerous time for your family at that time when you left?
Yeah, it was. And I talk about that in the book, and the threats and kind of having to leave overnight and the war starting. So we left from Croatia to Serbia, and then from Serbia to Australia. Lived in very, very difficult conditions. And
I thought, you know, you'd arrive in Sydney and see all the glitzy part in the east, and then you'd go to Fairfield. What was it like growing up in Fairfield?
Yeah, it wasn't very glitzy for us, and we lived in very difficult conditions, and at times didn't have anything to eat. So, and we already battled for 3 or 4 years before we came with the war. So it was tough. It was tough to get going and get started. And on top of that, all this, you know, pressure from my father and everything that I was going through with him and all the abuse. So
that had started at an early age.
Yeah, that started as soon as I started playing tennis when I was six. So I was already used to his abuse.
Were you good at sports from the beginning? Did you particularly like tennis? What drew you to it?
No, I was very good at pretty much, you know, all sports. I was very competitive. I was very competitive at school, and was pretty good at tennis, straight away.
What does winning a tournament feel like?
A lot of my what should have been good memories early on and in my career and when I started in the pros kind of always have a bad memory behind it because of everything that was going on and everything that my father put me through. But later on, when I kind of was able to enjoy some of my tennis, it's for me, you know, one of the greatest feelings in the world.
I think you said in your book that the better you played, the worse your father got. Mm-hmm. How did that work?
Yeah, it was never enough, and it was constantly about results and about money, and it was strange because I started, you know, playing very well. I was 4 in the world, and earning all this money just wasn't enough, and he got kind of worse. Yeah, to be honest with you, I don't know why. Some of those, you know, things and questions, I think those questions are for him to answer. I never got the answers to those questions, but ultimately that's what drove me to leave home at 19.
Was he drinking a lot during the period?
Yes. Yeah.
And do you think that was a prime reason or just added to...
Just an added reason.
...underlying problems that he's got?
Yeah, just an added reason because he was, he would be still very abusive and very bad even without drinking, but this just made it worse. So, and he started to drink more and more when we came to Australia, yeah.
You mentioned one incident in Wimbledon after you'd played Lindsay Davenport. And you'd done pretty well. You'd got to, was it the quarterfinals, I think? The semifinals of that tournament. And Lindsay Davenport was, you know, a huge, huge star from an early age. How did you feel when you weren't even allowed to go back and go back to your hotel room? And he didn't turn up. You didn't see him, did you?
Yeah, no, it was hard. You know, you played the semifinals of Wimbledon, you're 17 years old and doing so well, and he thinks, you know, by losing in the semis of Wimbledon, you're an embarrassment and a disgrace and doesn't allow me to come back home. So that was very, yeah, it was very hard because I had, you know, no money, no credit cards, nothing, and, you know, had to sleep in or try and sleep in the Wimbledon's players' lounge on a couch. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you have any friends on the circuit, people that supported you, other players, other people, you know, professional people?
When I left home, no, not really. It's quite a brutal sport and very individual. So, yeah, I struggled a little bit with that after I left home, with pretty much not having that much support. And, yeah, no one to really talk to, so struggled a little bit, yeah.
What was it like for the rest of the family? I mean, was he abusive to them as well?
Or? To my brother, no, not at all. My mum, yes, but nowhere near as much as he was to me.
When you were growing up, did you think, oh, this is the way things were, and then gradually you realised that there was something wrong? Or
For a while, look, it was normal because it was my everyday life. So it was something that I was living with every day. I knew that that's not what I wanted to go through, and I knew that that wasn't normal. If I didn't, I wouldn't have left at, you know, 19. So, yeah, I knew that that's not the right way to live. Yeah.
And you got a new coach, Bordabikic, and he had a younger brother.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened? How did you notice his younger brother?
No, he was at a tournament a couple of times, and you know, we started talking, and things kind of went on from there. That was 14 and a half years ago, and we're still together. So, yeah, I guess
so. There's something good
just meant to be. Yeah, just meant to be.
And did you find then after that? Was that sort of a catalyst for you to come back and say, look, I want to come back and be an Australian citizen again and play for Australia?
Oh, I wanted to do that straight away. It was just a matter of, you know, when, and I already wanted to do it a year before that I actually did it. I was just a little bit worried, you know, with the public's reaction and everything, because I knew that they didn't understand and that they didn't know that my father made me do it. It was hard to kind of explain that and show that. But when I did, yeah, look, I was, it was something I really, really wanted to do, felt like I really belong here.
Jelena Djokic, author of her new book, Unstoppable, Ending That Report by Roderick Chambers. I'm Philip Stempion, and you're listening to The Wire on Community and Indigenous Radio around Australia. This is The Wire on Community and Indigenous Radio across Australia, and hello if you're listening in Canberra on 2XX and 2 Bob Radio in Taree.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
The Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
That's it for The Wire today. You can find all our stories online at thewire.org.au, or you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your favourite download app. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for The Wire Radio, or one word. The Wire is a team effort by Radio 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide and 4EB in Brisbane, and you can hear us on your radio or online across Australia weekdays. We'll be back again tomorrow, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of 2SER 107.3 in Sydney. I'm Philip Stempien. Thank you very much for your company.
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.